So last week we learned the Gemara of Yishbi Benov and his attempt to capture and torment David. And what I said that this week you do is an analysis of that Gemara. I will certainly review it line by line with you, but not focus on so much on the Pshat. This is an opportunity for me to talk about methodologies in learning Agadita. So this Agadita I chose, as I mentioned to you, because I happen to have been teaching it in my Ashir in my shul. But it's an example of Agaditas that are just very fantastical. You go through them and like, what's this about? What does it mean? A little different from many of the Agaditas we've learned in the past. So I'd like to mention two classical approaches to these kinds of fantastical Agaditas, and then I will share with you my own approach. So the first one is the Pshat one, the literal one, Pshat. In other words, what the Agadita describes actually took place. So in the case of this story with Yishbi Benov and David, David actually was hunting a deer, and he ended up in the land of the Plishtim, and Yishbi Benov attacks him and tries to crush him, and the whole story unfolds with the Shechem and Farish, and David is hanging over the sword and he's having a conversation with Abishai. So the literalist approach would be to say that this actually took place, this actually happened. And I have no objection to that. That's a classical approach, and we are ma'aminim ne ma'aminim. This could very well have taken place. That there are alternative approaches is not to deny the possibility that the nisim that these Agaditas describe took place. They may well have taken place, and that's the literalist approach. It's probably the most popular one, I would say, most widespread. However, there are those who are dissatisfied with the literalist approach. I would say many of the rationalist Jewish thinkers, like the Rambam, son Rabbi Avraham ben Rambam, various Gaonim. I'll focus on the Rambam for a minute. The Rambam has a long discussion of Agaditas in his introduction to Perek HaChelek. And there he says that people who take these fantastical Agaditas literally are missing the point, and they are harming themselves and harming other people because they're kind of like forcing people to take things literally when they shouldn't necessarily be taken literally. And he's very critical of that approach. And in general, the Rambam's approach to understanding the world and Torah is to minimize nisim and maximize the idea that olam kemin hago noheg, the world goes according to its natural order, nisim are rare, interruptions to the course of nature are rare, and let's try to figure things out in a non-miraculous way. So the Rambam argues that many Agaditas and other midrashim need to be understood as mishalim, or as parables. That is, there's the simple reading of it, but the real meaning of it is this deeper meaning, which is often hidden, like golden apples behind filigrees of silver. And the task of the interpreter of the Agadita or the Medrash is to get to the deeper meaning. For the Rambam, this deeper meaning was philosophical. And these are the ideas he lays out in the Moreh Nebuchim. And when there are stories involved, then you might call these allegories. That is, the stories that took place are allusions to a whole other range of deeper concepts. And these deeper concepts are, to use a fancy term, reified. They're made concrete in the story that the Agadita tells. So the Agadita is really about other things, about philosophical ideas. And the story that's told is a reification of a concretization of these deep ideas. For Rambam, they were philosophical ideas. The Baalei Kabbalah, by the way, had an identical approach. They also maintain that Agaditas, Midrashim, are reifications of deep ideas, too. They're allegories for these deep ideas, but these deep ideas were not philosophical, but they were from Kabbalah. It's the same basic approach. A very similar approach in this overall allegorical school is of the Maral. I don't know if any of you have ever learned the Maral on Agadata, but the Maral is a very, very extensive discussion of this Agadata, as he has many, many Agadatas. You know, this is part of a four-volume work on Agadata, so his is one of the most deepest and most comprehensive discussions of Agadata, and they all follow his overall derech. So let me just read you little bits of it. V'yesh lefarish kol ha-ma'amar hazeh k'mashma'o, shahaya kach b'mucha shu'b'nigla. One can interpret the Agadata about Yishbi Benov and David as if this actually took place, b'muchash, in the real sensed world. That's one possible reading, so he acknowledges the literalist reading. But then he says, avol yosa nira lefarish kol ze'inyan sichli. It appears to me to be preferable to interpret this whole story with David and Yishbi Benov as something related to intellectual matters and not a literal rendition of what actually took place with David. On this non-literalist reading, David wasn't threatened physically by Yishbi. Yishbi didn't try to crush him under an olive press. This is an allegory. And the purpose of the allegory is to teach certain truths about the way the world is, and specifically... Harpa killed by Avishai? That's a good question, and for him it's also allegorical. It's a long... I'm not going to go through the whole thing. It's like several pages. So the basic idea that the Maharal develops is that... that this is an allegory about David's battle with the Yetzer Hara. Remember, it says that the Satan came down and appeared to him like a deer, and so he started to chase the deer and to hunt it, and that led him into Eretz Plishtim. So the Maral, following Chazal, maintains that the Satan is really a metaphor for the Yetzer Hara. And this is all about David HaMelech's battle with the forces of evil and temptation. And he of David was trying to chase the Yetzer, trying to kill the Yetzer, shooting an arrow at the Yetzer, right? That's the shooting of the arrow of the Yetzer at the deer is. He's trying to kill the Yetzer. The Yetzer tempts him and brings him into Eretz Plishtim, which is a land of Yetzer, a land of Chomer in the language, the philosophical language of the Maral. And Avishai chases after him to rescue him from the powers of the Yetzer Hara and temptation. This is all an allegory about the battle between a human being, David, on the one hand, and the Yetzer Hara on the other.
And Avishai.
Avishai was assisting David in the Yetzer Hara and fighting the Yetzer Tov and fighting the Yetzer Hara, assisting David in combating the Yetzer Hara. And he goes through the different details of the Agadata following this basic approach. So it's an allegory. It's an allegory for a battle between the human being and Yetzer Hara. And it's designed to teach us how you win, can you win, can't you win, the forces of temptation, how great they are. Eventually they do win, with two people assisting, be mechazik one another. It's an allegory for that great battle. And it's a very powerful interpretation. To my mind, the challenge with just like there's a challenge to the literalist reading, which may very well be an accurate reading, the challenge is that it doesn't comport with nature. The other challenge of the literalist reading is that it just seems so fantastical. Why would Chazal tell this fantastical story? In other words, just to repeat events? What does it teach? I mean, my overall assumption is Chazal want to teach us something deep about life, about what's important, and just telling a story... David, miracles, okay, maybe. But that's a challenge to the literalist reading. I'm not saying it's a reason to reject it, but it's a challenge. The allegorical interpretation provides an answer to that, which is that the reason we have these Agadotas is to teach us about deep ideas, Kabbalah, philosophy, whatever they are. It's a means of conveying in ways that people understand and can relate to, because it's a story, deep ideas. So I hear that the challenge to the allegorical reading is that you need to buy into the system for which it is an allegory. Now, you need to buy into the Maral's overall metaphysical world, which is uniquely his own, to follow completely the Maharal's interpretation. You need to buy into medieval philosophical ideas if you want to follow the medieval philosophical position. And for Kabbalah, you need to know a lot about Kabbalah, and it needs to work for you in terms of interpreting the Haggadah. So that's a challenge. I'm not saying it's a reason to reject it, but it's a challenge. So the approach that I'm going to suggest now, I will give it a name, is what I would call a psychological approach. That is, what I want to suggest to you is that the Haggadah is an acting out of certain psychological challenges, feelings, dilemmas that, in this case, David felt. And it acts it out as if it were a dream. And what I want to suggest to you is that one way to read this Haggadah and others like them is that they are dreams or portrayed as dreams, and that dreams provide a window into what's going on inside a person's inner life. If you learn Parakaroa, you will see that the dreams are a window into a person's inner life. So I want to suggest to you that what took place either in a dream that David had, and I'll explain what I mean by this in a minute, or the Baal Haggadah, Chazal, wrote it as if it were a dream, what they would imagine David would be dreaming and thinking and feeling about. Now, you will say, what evidence is there ever for Chazal to be interpreted as dreams? Actually, there is very ample evidence. So I will cite you some sources which take exactly that position. So for starters, there are many, many of them. If you want to read a summary of those sources, they're in the Maratz Chayas, Mavoa Talmud, Perek Shmon of Yesrim, 28. He collects quite a number of sources. I have them here. But I guess I'll start with Rabbi Avram ben Arambam, because maybe he's the most famous person who takes this position. You know, ever learn Ein Yaakov? The Ein Yaakov is the classic compendium of Haggadahs throughout Shas with various Mefarshim. So that's the best place to start when you learn an Haggadah, is to take, which is of course what I do, is to take the Ein Yaakov. Those are the classical Mefarshim collected by the author of the Ein Yaakov, collected by him. It's like the Gemara is sort of in the middle, then you have Rashi, Taisus, the Marsha, Ein Yaakov, Ein Yaakov, Eitz Yosef, the various Mefarshim around the... So the at the beginning in the of Ein Yaakov, the author published an essay by Rabbi Avram ben Arambam on how to learn Haggadahs, which is obviously very, I mean, it's a great Rishon, the son of the Rambam, so it's a very foundational essay. And he says as follows. He's talking about various Haggadahs, which are kind of far-fetched, exactly of the kind we're learning. And he says, there are some stories that appeared in a dream. And the Gemara mentions it as if it actually happened in clear and simple language. There's no fool who's going to think this literally took place. So therefore, they could write it in literal terms because it's obvious that it couldn't have been literal. And so he goes on to say that it was sometimes these stories are really dreams. The Rambam, in his introduction to Perek HaChelek, also mentions that as a possibility. Rabbeinu Hananel says it. The Ritva says it. Haigon says it. Shmuel Chafnigon says it. There are many, 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 many Gaonim and Rishonim. I'm not going to list them all. If you want, you can go do the research in Maratz Chayas. But another example, by the way, this is many of you familiar with the famous story of Taner of Achnai, the great debate with Rabbi Eliezer, and he was put into Cherem. Remember the tree moved up, the stream moved backwards, and the tree moved, and the coastline base of Medrash fell. Remember this? So I think it's Rabbeinu Hananel there who says, or one of the Rishonim, who says, this didn't really take place. It may well have been a dream. Somebody was in the base medrash and he was dremeling. You know, he was like dozing off, and this is what he kind of saw. And that's a very famous Haggadah. And here you have, I think it was Rabbeinu Hananel who takes that view.
Are
That took place. But the bad part about the traveling trees and the water flowing backwards, that was a dream. Not the whole thing was a dream, just that. Okay, so there is ample precedent for the view that from Rishonim and Gaonim. So it's not important to me, I want to stress this, whether this was literally a dream or the Baal HaGadot wanted to enter into David HaMelech's mind and heart and did so by conveying what he thought David HaMelech would be dreaming about. It's not material to me, but that's the basic approach. It's psychological because it brings us in. So all the symbols that are not symbols toward of some abstract philosophical or ideas from Kabbalah, all the symbols in the dream, the story is about what's going on in David's mind and heart and neshama. So it brings it down to our human experience, and therefore it makes that think, for me anyway, a very powerful way and a very important musardika way, so to speak, to read this Agadata. So that's the kind of theoretical background. Now let's go back into the Agadata, and I'll summarize it. I mean, let's go, I'm not going to read the whole thing carefully line by line, but I'll just go through what happens, and I'll share with you this interpretation that I am proposing to you. So it's the Agadata starts, you all have the text, the Agadata starts by saying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to David, Ad masa yiyah avon zeh tomen biyadacha, how long will this sin be hidden in your hands? As you are culpable for the death of the Kohanim in Ir Nov, Nov Ir HaKohanim, and other the tragedies that were related to that. So, how does the Kadosh Baruch Hu speak to us? One way is through Mar'e Nevuah, and the other is through a dream. So it could very well be, now David HaMelech may not have been the full stature of a Navi, but he had Ruach HaKodesh, Rambam says in the Mar'e Nevuchim, but Ruach HaKodesh could also be conveyed through dreams, and that's, Rambam says those are the two basic vehicles for conveying Nevuah, either a Mar'e Nevuah or a Chalom. So right off the bat, if you read it from that perspective, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, like, what David HaMelech, what this is, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if you ask me personally, Moshe Sokol, I think HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to each and every one of us, not through prophetic powers, because at least I am not a Navi, but through our Yetzer Tov, through our Neshama. Hashem speaks to us, and we have a Neshama, we have a Yetzer Tov. And that Hashem created us with that. And that's, you might say, how HaKadosh Baruch Hu communicates to us through our conscience, through our sense of what's right and wrong. And one way to read this communication from Hashem to David is either via a dream or via his conscience. David was himself profoundly troubled by what he had done. David was an incredible tzaddik. Would it be surprising to you that David HaMelech wasn't tormented at some level by his culpability for the annihilation of Nov Ir HaKohanim? It would be, in a sense, surprising if he weren't troubled by it. After all these people died as a result of his taking refuge there. So David is now tormented by this. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives him a choice. Do you want to die, or do your descendants want to die? Or you allow your descendants to die? That, if you think about it, is a recapitulation of the choice he made in going into Nov Ir HaKohanim. Save his own skin, or endanger Nov Ir HaKohanim and all of their descendants. Right? If Nov, the whole city is annihilated, then there are no descendants. So what comes first? My life or the lives of many, many others? David, at that time, chose his own life. Now HaKadosh Baruch Hu is presenting him through his dream or through his conscience a recapitulation of exactly that choice. Do you save yourself or your descendants? Now, David, what's that?
Who's your descendants in that sense, then?
Excuse me?
Who's David's
his descendants?
Are you saying
redundant
to say, save yourself or save your descendants, because by saving yourself, you're saving your descendants. So if
All of his descendants would die. He would live, but he would never have children, and all of his descendants would die. You could ask.
How is that an argument of conscience? How does your conscience know what's going to happen in the future?
No, his choice was, I'll risk my life. I'll allow myself to die so as to save others. That's exactly what he chose not to do in the case of Novir Khanum.
Right, so I'm saying children is referring to Novir Khanum?
It's analogous. It's either yourself or others.
Right.
Right? So in the case of Nov, it was himself or others. In the case, the dilemma Hashem is presenting with, do you save yourself or do you allow others to die? So it's a parallel to the very moral challenge that he faced when he entered into Nov. So he says, properly, I am willing to... what I did with Nov was wrong, and I'll sacrifice my life to save others. So it's a kind of a tshuva. But then the process continues. So he goes on this hunt. And he sets out nets to trap animals. So remember, think of this psychologically. Say it's a dream or psychologically. This is a kind of, you might say, a nightmare in a way that David is having. Because he gets trapped and the whole thing is... We all had anxiety dreams or nightmares. Every person has them. This is like a nightmare. You know, he goes on a hunt and then he gets trapped by Yishmael Nov. He gets crushed. It has a nightmarish quality to it, which is why they say it has a dreamlike, fantastical quality to it. But I think that the symbolism of going hunting is a real one because David may well feel himself trapped by his own poor choice. He made a terrible mistake, and as a result, the entire city of Nov was destroyed. So he may feel himself trapped as a result of that terrible choice he made. His conscience is like crushed, is trapping him. Like, and he goes on a hunt. In effect, you might say he's hunting himself. His neshama, his Yetzer Tov, is going on a hunt to capture the failed aspect of David's life. It's a kind of a, you might say, is his conscience is punishing himself. He's punishing himself by chasing after him and going after a hunt. It's a kind of like, you know, he remains alive, but nevertheless, he eventually goes into exile. Exile meaning exile from himself. Because he wasn't the David that he could have been, and that he knew he was. That he should have been. He allowed an entire city to... So he kind of goes on this hunt, in a sense, to Yetzer Tov, is tormenting him and chasing after him. He is like the deer. He is like the tzvi who's done this terrible thing. So he's chasing after himself in a way. And he goes into exile because David has, in effect, from his own guilty conscience, gone into exile from the person he should have been. He's alienated. Distance from his Yetzer Tov, from his Neshama, because of look what he did with Novir HaKohen. So he goes on this hunt and he goes to Eretz Plishtim, and when Yishbi Benov sees him, he recognizes who he is, and what does he do? He crushes him. You've ever felt, had this experience of having really done something that you regret and feeling very guilty about it? So you could feel yourself trapped by your guilt. You could certainly feel yourself crushed. Have you ever had this experience? Maybe you never did anything that you really deeply regret. I don't know. But if you do, and of course Yom Kippur is about this, tshuva, you feel yourself crushed under your own failures. Isn't that a fair metaphor for feeling how, you know, oh, I did this, that's terrible, I'm crushed under this burden of my failures. He ties him up and he crushes him. And that's a psychological expression in nightmarish form of the agony, the moral agony, the tshuva that David is undergoing as a result of this whole experience. He dreams this nightmare. It comes as like a tshuva process. Now, let's digress for a moment to talk about Yishbi Benov and his mother Arpa. You'll recall later from the Agadita that when Avishai chased after David to try to rescue him, he comes upon Arpa, right? And she tries to throw the spindle at him to kill him. Hardly an effective weapon, wooden spindle to kill a massive soldier. Avishai, in turn, kills her with that spindle. So let's think for a moment about what we know about ARPA. So what do we know from Megillas Rus? Right. So both ARPA and Rus were devoted daughters-in-law of Naomi. They both married two sons of Naomi. They're both very devoted. They both follow Naomi up to a point. And then Naomi insists that they go back, and ARPA is finally persuaded to go back, whereas Rus continues with Naomi. Now, if you just look at the Megillas Rus, anything negative about ARPA? No, I mean, maybe she wasn't the incredible tzaddikus of Rus. By the way, David is a descendant of Rus, as you know, right? So this is all very significant in terms of the Agadita. So Rus was an extraordinary tzaddikus. She followed Naomi to the bitter end, eventually was very successful. So ARPA was not at that same level of tzaddikus, but she was a very loyal daughter-in-law. She really wanted to go with Naomi, and she left, and she was ready to go until Naomi finally persuaded her. So you don't get a negative portrayal of ARPA and Megillas Rus. Is that correct? However, Chazal in Maseches Sota, Daf Mem Beis, portray ARPA in a horrific light. And they say that she became, in various ways that I won't go into, that she became sexually depraved and exceedingly promiscuous after that episode. Obviously, that wasn't the case before, but eventually she became awful, really corrupt, depraved, and they all darshan, you know, through her name, ARPA. And this Gemara here is of a piece with that, because here she's not exactly a friend of the Jews. And her two sons become nemeses of the Jews. So if you look at it from a kind of Chazal, and also from the perspective of Jewish history, I mean, Golias was an enemy of the Jews. So her son became an enemy of the Jews. So we get from historical perspective, and especially from Chazal, get a very different picture of ARPA. So the question is, if in Megillas Rus, ARPA was really a basically good person, like, why did she become sexually depraved? I mean, depraved and promiscuous in unimaginable ways. Like, how did that happen? Here she was, a very fine lady. She wanted to go with Naomi. So how do you account for that radical metamorphosis from very fine lady, if not super tzaddikus, to awful enemy of the Jews, mother of two enemy of the Jews? Like, how do you understand that? So I will suggest a way of thinking about it, which is also psychological. If you do something bad and you regret it, then you feel guilty about it and you get angry at yourself for making that mistake, and you have to prove that you kind of have to, almost in anger and guilt, that's who I really am. You know, I really am a terrible creep. That's why I did these things. In other words, think of ARPA as having the capacity of joining Klal Yisrael and going with Naomi, and look what happened to Rus eventually. She probably knew that. She's thinking to herself, why did I do that? How could I have missed this opportunity to become close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to join Klal Yisrael, to remain with Naomi? What a jerk I am. I'm just an awful person. And that anger at oneself gives rise to behavior that justifies that choice. Of course I didn't do that. I'm a creep. I was never worthy of going along with Naomi and being kind of Klal Yisrael and achieving levels of Kedusha. I'm a creep, and I'm going to prove to you I'm a creep. And she acts like a total creep. And there's a kind of a hatred, in effect, that she may have felt for Klal Yisrael, or for Rus, who joined Klal Yisrael, because you, Rus, showed me how bad I am. You made the right choice. So you illuminated my failures. Had Rus never made that choice, Harper wouldn't have felt so bad about herself, because nobody actually did it. So she feels this anger at herself for having failed, and anger at Rus for having illuminated her own failures. In contrast, now, this is the contrast. If you have no contrast, you don't, you know, you're not a failure. If somebody doesn't get a, you know, 100 in organic, and you don't get 100, okay, so that's so bad. But if somebody gets 100 in organic, and you get your, you know, 55 or 72, you think you really get, feel like a total failure. Get rid of the guys at the top, and then you're with everybody else. So what I am suggesting to you is that ARPA, interchangeable names, she ended up failing, feeling angry at herself for that failure and angry at Rus, a.k.a. David, and that whole line for illuminating her failure. And that hatred was a hatred that she conveyed to her children. Why was Gullius and why was Yishbi? Why were they such enemies of David? Because this goes back to Harpa's own anger. And you recall at the very, very end of the Agadita, how did they end up, Avishai and David, killing Yishbi Benov? What did they tell him? Remember? Yes, they tell him that his mother was dead. With his mother's death, that fountain of hatred and anger subsided, and he lost his power. His power derived from his mother's ancestral anger at Rus, eventually David, at Klal Yisrael, at Kedusha. And as soon as that anger dissipated, he lost his power. Because his power was from that anger that his mother taught them in their mother's milk. You with me? So that kind of explains the mystery of why at the very end they're able to kill him. Just mentioning his mother? Okay. I mean, the guy's a big, tough warrior. It's sad that his mother died, but would that be a reason for him to be unable to... He was chasing Avishai and David and chasing them. So I think that there's a deeper psychological force behind Yishbi Benov's anger at and hatred of David, and that's partially what's playing out here. Okay, so... the story continues. David escapes from that crushing guilt because there is still room for him to survive. You know, the earth, remember, gets soft underneath him. And Avishai then chooses, hears that David is gone and wants to save him. And everything takes place Erev Shabbos. By the way, Erev Shabbos is a very significant time because it is what people call it. Scholars call a liminal period. It's a transitional period from one to the other. There's Chol. Shabbos is Kedusha. And Erev Shabbos is like you're already getting ready for Shabbos and you're preparing for Kedusha. So you're entering into that phase of Kedusha. And that's really where David was kind of hanging between the Kedusha of his tshuva and of what he wants to be and the Chol, the failures. And Erev Shabbos kind of is a symbol of that transition that David is sinking. In any case, Avishai, his nephew, sees blood. Blood is a stain of, remember Macbeth? What does Macbeth try to do? Did you ever study, did you ever read Macbeth? What's that? Yes, Macbeth, who is responsible for the murder, has blood on her hands, and she tries to wash her hands because blood is a stain, a red mark of guilt, and no, you're not calling him. They all died in a bloody way. So Avishai via David, through this dream, this is a nightmare, kind of, or something like that. So David feels Avishai, David dreams or imagines that Avishai feels this blood guilt for him. He's trying to wash out of his hair, so to speak, you know, but this blood, he can't quite get it out of his hand. Or the other, you'll recall, the other Ikadiyamri, the Gemara's Tula Shonos, the other Lashon was that there was a Yonah, a bird that was fluttering and kind of attacking Avishai and attacking itself. It was like, let's look at the Lashon of Rashi. Itref Kameh, about 7 or 8 lines in the Rashi. Haisa torefes umechabetes atzmo. Doesn't say Avishai. It was banging its wings against itself. Yonah here symbolized, as the Gemara says, Yonah is a symbol for Klal Yisrael, which Shema Amina Avishai says that David is in trouble, this Yonah is not necessarily smiting Avishai. Who is the Yonah smiting? Itself, right? That's what Rashi says, Atzma. It's like this is David's nightmare of the Yonah attacking itself. Like David's conscience is attacking him. He's tormented. This Yonah is tormented, hits itself, bangs itself. David is tormented, right? Because that's the overall motif of the Agada, David's torment, great tzaddik that he was, for his own failure to prevent the murder of Novi Rakonim. Okay, so notice, by the way, that what does Avishai say? He says, Shma mina David Malka di Yisrael bitsa'ara. Would you have used the word sa'ara to describe David's situation just in the literalist reading of this? You would say, well, he's in sakana, right? You would say he's about to die. He doesn't say that. He says he's in sar, which is an apt description on this psychological moral reading of the Agadah. David is bitsar. He is in torment. And this is, of course, all part of David's nightmarish dream about himself. That's the word he would use, because that is an apt description of his own condition. He is Bitsara. Okay. I don't have time to get into this, but I did a little research. There's a sefer called Otsar Agada. You ever see that? It's a collection of Agadatas on themes, and so the symbolism of a Yonah in a Chazal is quite significant, and I think bears on Dava, but I won't go into that right now. In any case, for another time or later. Avishai goes on to David HaMelech's preda, mule. Now, they used predos in those days. I mentioned to you last time. I did a little research about that. But a preda is made of an illicit coupling, or a coupling between two different species. Does that remind you of anything in David's life? Yes. Preda somehow, I could imagine David thinking, dreaming about this Preda. He's kind of engaged in, you know, donkey horse activities, illicit, perhaps, or problematic couplings. In any case, he beats up, takes his whole Shiloh, we discussed that last time, you know, about you're allowed to take the king's dunk and mule or not. In any case, he goes and he meets up with Harpa. Harpa tries to kill him. So I ask you the following question. Is it not irrational for Harpa to try to kill Avishai, this mighty warrior, with a wooden spindle? Like, doesn't that seem a little far-fetched? So how would you answer that question based upon the analysis I've suggested?
Spindle's like the Rumpelstiltskin, the little one touch of poison.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay. But why would she do that? It's a crazy thing to do. I mean, it's a crazy thing to do. It's irrational to throw this spindle to kill a big warrior. Obviously, he's going to try to kill her. What?
You're full of rage.
Exactly. That's a symbol or an expression of her anger. People who, as Ellie said, people who are enraged don't act rationally. What she was doing was not rational. But she was so full of anger and hatred, anger itself, anger at Yerush, anger at David, that she did crazy things. You can't, because that rage drove her to irrational behavior. Yes?
What's the symbolism of a spindle?
I don't know. I don't know if they're... Not every element in a dream, as the Gemara makes clear in a Perek Aroa, has symbolic significance. Some stuff is just there.
It's so, an interesting object.
Yeah, it is.
Like, you're expecting to throw a stone at least, or throw dirt.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, yes, I agree with that, and it's Sarachian, and maybe we can all think about it some more and figure out what it might be. I mean, I think that weaving is, maybe here we can think about it in these terms. I mean, she's kind of a weaving a net, so to speak, to trap David in. In other words, this net of hatred and anger and her children. So the symbol is the spindle is an aspect of that weaving. Does that, by the way, this idea of weaving remind you of anything in classical literature, if I might throw something in? The Odyssey, Penelope, if you may remember. She's always weaving. weaving memories, weaving the past, weaving connections. So she, in this case, you know, maybe she's weaving a net. It's like David goes to hunt with a net, and she also has a net. So there's this weaving, this motif of trapping. I don't know. In any case, worth thinking about. This whole approach, by the way, to my mind that I'm suggesting to you, this whole psychological approach, does provide us with really, I think, rich tools to unpack an otherwise agarata, which is like really just fantastical. You can agree or disagree with the interpretation, but it does provide a set of tools to really excavate what this agarata is trying to do in ways that somehow I relate to as a human being, not because these are these ideas out there, but because David is a human being who's struggling with the kinds of things that every one of us struggles with, and here is an expression of how the Gemara depicted him as struggling with it. So to me, it resonates in certain ways. Okay. What does Yishbi do? He throws David up in the air and plants a sword bottom up in the ground so that David will fall on the sword. So the question I asked you last time, and the obvious question is, like, why doesn't he just stab him? Why does he throw him up in the air and have him land on his sword?
He does more blood on his own hands, more indirect.
Why would he even care if he has blood on his own hand? Like, he's not worried about it. He hates David. Plishtim didn't like the Jews. Like, well,
because David now knows what it feels like to have blood in his own hands. And
I mean, David wouldn't want Yishbi to...
David's dreaming about this, so therefore it's David's mindset. Of
right, they wouldn't... Okay, that's an interesting thought. It's an interesting thought.
David's on tap, and Yishbi said, I'm still going to get you.
Yishbi takes a sword from the bottom... puts it in the ground so that the sharp part is sticking up, and he throws David in the air so David will land on the sword.
I think David, you're on top, but I'm going to get you still.
David's going to get him? He throws him up.
Yishbi.
Oh.
David, you're on top, right? I'm going to get you still.
Okay, I hear that. I don't know if we would think that he was on top, yes?
David wasn't directly responsible for the murder.
Perfect! That's the way I read it. That's the way I understand it. This exactly recapitulates David's situation. David didn't kill Nov. Right? He didn't kill Nov Irakonim. What he did was the annihilation of Nov Irakonim was collateral damage to his attempt to save himself. But he didn't directly kill him. This is exactly the same situation with which David would be dreaming about his own demise. He would not be killed directly, just that he didn't kill Nov directly. Just as Nov was indirectly killed, so too David would be dreaming, or the Baal HaGadot would have David dream, that he will be killed indirectly. It's an exact recapitulation. Great. That's the way I understood it. Exact recapitulation of the situation with Nov. Now he's suspended over the air, right? So you imagine, it's like, here's a sword. David is hanging in the air, way up there. And then Avishai comes to try to save him. But to my mind, this is a brilliant image of David's situation and identity. David is hanging between heaven and earth. He is a Kadosh Ein Kamoho, author of Tehillim, one of the greatest of all men. And yet he, in this case, failed. At least that's what Hashem is telling him. You know, you made a bad mistake. And there were other challenges in David's life as well, with Bathsheba, as you mentioned. So in some ways, this is a brilliant image of David's own self-image. Like, who am I, David is saying. Am I in the air? Or am I on the ground with the sword waiting for me, which I deserve? And it's, you know, David is in a sense questioning his own identity. There are these extremes in David. It's incredible kedusha, and yet he was also a military man, a warrior. They kill a lot of people. You know, he was a tough person as well. And there are contradictions in David's, it's part of David's godless, really, if you ask me. It's part of his kedusha, his godless, that he has these different dimensions. But this image of David hanging above the air, min shamayim to aretz, to me is a brilliant symbol of David's own attempt to capture his identity and who he is. So how does he get saved through the Shema Meforesh. That's temporary, but the more permanent salvation is that Avishai tells him to reverse his decision. Remember? Whereas before he said, I will sacrifice my life to preserve my descendants, he reverses his decision and that saves him. So the kasha is, the obvious kasha on the Agadah is like, how could David do that? How could he sacrifice his descendants to save his own skin? That's like exactly what he seemed to have failed to have done in the case of Noah, which is what this tshuva was. So how do you understand this reversal? Why does it save his life? Or why does he do this? I mean, it's a serious question. You all with me? Yes.
Maybe for Klal Yisrael as a whole, it was good. Better for David to exist. So for him personally, so the parallel is for him personally, it would feel better for him to die, because that for him would feel like it was making up for sin.
Great.
Really the correct answer.
Perfect. Wonderful. That's exactly the way I would want to read it. David recognized, well, let's put it in Avishai's terms. The Yonah is banging. Shema mina Yisrael, Klal Yisrael is in trouble. But it's David who's in trouble. So what does he mean to say that Klal Yisrael is in trouble? The answer is, Klal Yisrael without David is in trouble. Klal Yisrael required David HaMelech for all of the incredible impact he had on Klal Yisrael's physical well-being, on its ruchnius, on its kedusha. Without David HaMelech, could you imagine where we would be without David HaMelech? Just think about it historically. Look what David HaMelech did for Klal Yisrael. So, David HaMelech, let me just cut it. David HaMelech first chose his descendants over himself. But what he came to realize is that he and his descendants are one, and what really matters is Klal Yisrael. And that's a more accurate mirror of the Noah-David choice. David now is willing to it's an awful thing to sacrifice your descendants, right? It's a terrible thing. Can you imagine all of one's descendants dying? It's a terrible thing. And David is saying, I'm willing to allow my descendants to die so that I, as the Yonah, can go back and lead Klal Yisrael, and that's more important to me than anything else. And so that is, you might say, the deepest element of tshuva that David is doing for Noah, because he is recognizing that Klal Yisrael, Nov, Irak Kohanim, is more important than he and his descendants. And he's only saving himself. It's worse in some ways to see all of one's descendants dies and for you to live. It's a horrible fate to think of all of one's descendants is dying, but he's willing to do that for the greater good of Klal Yisrael. So he now has a different vision of his descendants, himself, and Klal Yisrael, and Nov is a part of Klal Yisrael. So in some ways it's a more accurate, more apt tshuva to what he did before. Yes.
So why would David get punished for the killing of Noah in the first place if his survival was so important?
Why was he punished?
Yeah. We're saying that David survived.
No, maybe he should have taken refuge somewhere else, not in a place that might have risked Noah. Maybe your Kohanim, maybe he should have gone to a cave or tried something else. I mean, he had to have known that Shaul, who was a vengeful man full of anger at him, could have done terrible things. And David HaMelech was a great man. This chet may not be a chet for you and me. It may have been a chet for David HaMelech. I mean, we can't really assess. I don't know what his options were, what his choices were, as far as hiding is concerned. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu was blaming him. I mean, at least according to the Agadah. So, however we are to interpret it, he had alternatives. Yes, yes, yes.
Actually, don't we see that David's descendants don't all die?
Yes, the Mepharshim discussed that. So maybe you
discussed that.
What's that? It's discussed that there are descendants who do live. Well, I think the Marsha maybe talks about somebody.
I'm a babe, I think.
The Gemara discussed it. Okay, in any case, I don't remember now, but it is discussed, and there was some I think descendants maybe were born afterwards this event or whatever. Good question.
I found that killed all his descendants except for one, because there was one survivor of Noah.
Say that again?
There's one survivor of Noah, therefore one of his descendants survived.
Oh, right. Okay, yes, right. That's right. That rings a bell. Right. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. I think that's correct. Okay, let's just finish the Agadah. So in the end, the two of them, Avishai, together with David, cannot conquer Yishbi. David's guilt still pursues him. He's not fully, it hasn't been fully resolved. The death of his harpa is what, like, Shimshon kind of steals his, the power which comes from anger in the case of, and rage from mother, which comes from, and Ishbi is eventually killed as after his mother dies. And in the end, David survives because he has made the sacrifice of his descendants for the greater good of Klal Yisrael. And that becomes the ultimate takeaway message from this Agadita. One message being David's struggle through this dream or dream-like sequence or nightmare-like sequence with his conscience, which is HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaking to him. And by the way, that's important because I do think Moshe Sokol now, and you know, putting in a little parenthetical comment, I do believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to every one of us personally. I think that through our conscience, through our Yetzer Tov, that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling us to get up for davening, to learn well, to do what we need to do. That's HaKadosh Baruch Hu talking to us in his, in the way he created us. And eventually this language became so powerful to David, this, that David reversed himself, did tshuva for Nov, and decided to sacrifice his descendants for the greater good of Klal Yisrael, and that remains another final takeaway in the ultimate resolution to this torment that this Agadah portrays David as having undergone. Okay? Any questions? Yes?
If we're saying this whole thing was a dream, what was the importance of it being Avishai as opposed to anyone else?
Good question. Good question. I mean, it was his nephew and he was close to him, and maybe he would have, because of that, because he's his nephew, because he maybe has that Rus connection, would be a part of this larger picture of the Arpa Rus hatred and the way it plays down into Yishbi's hatred towards Avishai and David. Avishai and David represent, because they're related, this Rus versus Arpa challenge. It's a good question. Plenty of questions to ask, and I hope that this has given you food for thought. And also a way of thinking about Agadotas that you find difficult to learn.